sound set.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The Fed blinked. Republicans debated and I was entertained. Markets, economy, and outlook. All this and much more on episode number 430 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, a good Sunday to you. How are you? Andrew Horowitz here of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, where we come together each and every week to talk about things related to the markets and question some of the things that we hear about that may seem a little bit off the traditional, the usual, the Main Street kind of mainstream kind of logic that we try to bust apart a little bit here and talk about some of the things that really mean a lot more to us as investors, planners for our future, etc. I want to thank you for a lot of emails. It seems a lot of people were on board with my recent discussion and as we call it, my little rants about advertising and ads inside of whether it's your, you know, mobile device, whether it's on the web, become quite obtrusive. And a lot of you had the same kind of thoughts. Now, what's interesting is that Apple, in their latest update and some other commentary I've been reading, there's a lot more ad blockers and ability for users to block advertisements. It reminds me a bit of the hacker world, right? You know, the more we encrypt and secure, the smarter the hackers have to become to figure out ways to get around it. And it would seem logical to me that many of the advertisers will do the same somehow. I mean, remember advertising used to be just quick banners, things that were easy. You had a video that you had to click. Now you go to a web page with a video and it starts automatically. How obnoxious is that? We're not going to get into this whole thing. If you want to look at and listen to my discussion on advertising and my comments, that was in episode number 429. So I think that you should do that. You know, I also got some great feedback on some recent guests that I wanted to share with you. If you didn't listen, make sure to go to the show notes over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com for this particular episode, episode number 430. And I have some links in there that we put in for guests on Colin Roche and Russ Roberts. They were, I thought they were great guests too. And a lot of people had written in saying, hey, have them back more. And, you know, you got to get those guys back. So I thought that to make sure that you are up to where you should be with listening, you can find it on the iTunes store, of course, or the podcast app. You can go over to the site, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and find it there. Those two in particular, very recent guests, I thought were very, very interesting and something that you should definitely listen to. Well, let's talk about what happened this week. So there was this, you know, incredible anticipation, this just amazing amount of energy that was spent trying to handicap what the Fed was going to do. There was a lot of discussion on whether it was print media, CNBC had a countdown clock, constantly asking guest after guest, what is the Fed going to do, considering all the things that are out there and considering all the things that are currently presenting themselves in terms of economic conditions in the United States, as well as what's happening overseas, China, Europe, Japan, etc. So Janet Yellen takes the stage with at 2 o'clock, releasing the, actually she was 2:30, but 2 o'clock was the release of the official rate decision, and the Fed did not change it at all. Now, if you remember, I talked about how I thought that they should actually raise the lower bound from the current 0% to 0.25% to, as crazy as it sounds, to 0.125% and leave it flat at 0.125%. And then all of a sudden you get both sides, right? Well, it looks like we're raising the bottom, but we're lowering the top. So you kind of get stimulus and tightening at the same time. But obviously I'm the only idiot that thought of that. But I don't know if you could do it. It would break tradition of quarter point moves, or at least in quarter point intervals. So now all of a sudden markets are really happy with that. I mean, immediately after the release. Now, if you listen to DH Unplugged last week, I talked about how the first move is usually the wrong move. And I said statistically what I've seen, or at least observed, is that usually the first major move after a Fed release is oftentimes reversed. It seems that there's a massive amount of either short covering or buying or selling, whatever it may be, but disappointment, rebalancing of positions that were put on in ahead of the actual rate announcement. But essentially, I guess we're going to call it the Fed blinking because they blew it. See, what happened is the Fed was coming out with commentary, particularly at their 2:30 press conference with Janet Yellen, that talked about the reasons for why they actually left rates unchanged. And while they have the dual mandate of, one, unemployment at a certain level and full unemployment, right now they're targeting that at 5.1% and inflation at 2%, which, by the way, kind of an interesting twist on this. The concept of inflation at 2% has always been that the Fed will get inflation towards 2% and then they'll start hiking. Looking at this differently, because there's a great article I read over the weekend, I think it was a Bloomberg article, talked about how maybe it shouldn't be looked at as a place to get to, but a cap. In other words, the Fed's not going to let inflation get past 2%. So what they're looking for is containing inflation with what they're doing. A little bit of a twist on the same conversation, right? Pushing it to a point or containing it up to a point. And we're pretty close to that. I mean, a year-over-year basis, when you look at CPI, PPI, I mean, you know, getting in the range of close enough to 2% and employment at 5.1% to a level where it would seem logical that a rate hike, at least adjusting the lower bound of where we are today, makes a lot of sense. So the Fed doesn't talk about that. They talk about they get there, but the main thing that they start to talk about that really starts to rock markets and take it from a 1.2 or 1.3% move to the upside down throughout the rest of the day, you know, till it closes down. I think it closed down 1.5% or something like that. Was this? They talked about the global headwinds, particularly they mentioned China and they mentioned the global economies. They in the conversations that followed the question and answer period, there was a variety of different topics discussed that all had to do with things outside of their mandate. And the concern that comes in here is that, number one, why is the Fed so concerned? Like, what's happening? What is really going on? Do they know something? The second thing is that the Fed pretty much signaled that they were going to raise rates. They were comfortable with the way the economy was going. They felt that employment was in good place, et cetera. And all of a sudden, they changed their tune a bit, maybe because they're scared of something. And that's what really rocked markets. A lot of people I know and a lot of people in the business I talked to after that, and a lot of them were really pissed off. They're like, they cannot believe that the Fed is unable to actually pull the trigger here when we are seeing such economic conditions that seem better. They want better employment. They want better economic conditions. They want to see inflation tick up a little bit higher. And now all this does is create further uncertainty. Think about what this did. It creates a tremendous amount of uncertainty moving forward because now we're going to have to deal with this whole crapola dot plot thing that they put out, trying to be transparent. And if they were transparent, like I said, they would have raised because the transparency and the conversations leading up into this meeting were all about, it looks like it's time, but they didn't. So the fact is their transparency is kind of in question. Confidence in the Fed is in question of their ability to get us to the point and to be factual and truthful in what they are doing. Because, of course, a lot of investors have been handicapping and preparing their quote-unquote bets ahead of a rate change appropriately, and all of a sudden they don't do it. Now we're talking about a December rate rise. Now, interestingly enough, over the weekend, there's been a lot of commentary that's come out about, hey, we're really right on the precipice. Fed officials talking about, you know, we're right there. There was a majority or a good chunk of them, at least most, which is kind of weird if you have a majority and then they go the other way. But a majority of Fed officials that said we should actually hike rates. One said there should be negative rates. But now we're in a situation where we're going to have to watch the economic conditions. Even though the next meeting is scheduled for December, there has been some talk about an unscheduled potential meeting, or this has been jockeyed around and about maybe that will be the time when they raise. They got really nervous, I think, after they saw that market participants really weren't too happy about it. But let me give you the list of things that I kind of drummed up and thought of what really the problem here is and why the Fed blew it. So I mentioned that it creates more indecision and confusion, less confidence in the Fed as they stray from their mandate or their dual mandate. Now the markets are going to be nervous coming into each and every meeting about what's going to happen. You know, we got this whole anticipation, this buildup, and, you know, this whole buy the rumor, sell the news concept that happens quite often. Markets are going to be very concerned and very watchful and on pins and needles as we go through here, especially because they talked about a unscheduled meeting potential for the next rate hike. So now we don't know what's going on and how they may surprise markets. Again, so much for transparency. I think that markets are very worried that there's no more firepower from the Fed to combat the global slowdown. And that's what's really going on here, that if the Fed here in the U.S. actually raised rates after the IMF and the World Bank had said, hey, you know what, please do not, you don't understand, you know, by raising rates, you're going to, you know, really hit the dollar and move it higher. And that's really going to be a problem for emerging markets. And it's really causing a major slowdown in the rest of the world. And there's a lot of pressure on them not to. And the fact is, if we're at a zero bound already and we have a very easy policy around the world, the concern is that really the current firepower, the amount and ability of Federal Reserve and central banks around the world are unable to combat this deflationary spiral that we seem to be continuing, you know, entering into. Fed clearly appears scared about China. They didn't talk about it being a transient or temporary situation about the global economy. And I think that spooked investors and what really caused some concern. I think there was also the whole point about with regard to that the Fed doesn't really talk about global issues very often. Every once in a while, they hint about the strength of the dollar. They'll talk about maybe a couple of things every here and there. But usually when they do, there's something much bigger behind it. So all told, I would probably give the Fed a D minus for their efforts in this particular meeting. I think that really a lot of confidence was lost. We'll have to see what happens. There's also options expiration. And this Friday, and that caused a lot more volatility, a lot more positioning. The one thing that is a bit concerning is that if you remember the last options expiration that occurred on a Friday, the weekend before that gigantic drop on the Monday, on the 24th of August, markets also sold off pretty tremendously. And we're looking to get out of positions for the weekend. And then Monday started a pretty rough avalanche for markets. Question is whether or not we're going to enter that kind of situation, whether it's Monday or moving forward into the next week as we come into seasonality patterns that are pretty negative for markets. The end of September is usually a pretty rough time for markets for whatever particular reason. And we're entering into that moving forward and we're there. So we're going to have to see what happens. I wanted to talk about what actually really didn't fare well at all when it comes to markets starting on, you know, I guess, prior to the meeting, starting from last Wednesday and last week, and talk about what's happening in the markets. Financials definitely did not do well. I mean, financials were really a problem. And you saw that there was a pretty big sell-off in that sector. Technology also did not well. Small caps held up okay. And they've been holding up. I mean, they were the first to drop, and they're definitely seeing some deep scars. But generally speaking, I noticed that even with some of the days that markets fall, the large caps are taking it much harder. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that there's some earnings concerns with the strong dollar and the global environment. Small caps oftentimes are more domestically oriented. They have much more business in the U.S. And if the U.S. is doing better and employment's doing better, and you see that, you know, generally speaking, the economy here compared to other places is better, you would think that people would believe that the small caps, the companies that really do a lot more domestic business, will be doing a lot better than those that are multinationals, those that have a lot more of their revenue that can be traced back to, you know, place around the world. So when we look at that, we see that really the emerging markets didn't do well since we got that information out. You know, we saw a pretty big hit on, I'm trying to look here. I mean, India got smacked really badly, about 6% the last few days. Brazil got hit hard. And that's because oil finally started moving down, not to mention all the problems that they have there. You know, the U.S. dollar itself, first, when the announcement came out, fell, and then it rallied. Major rally. Because, again, what happens here? While the Fed is not raising, which should be negative on the valuation of the dollar compared to other countries where it stands at this point, or at least it should not really necessarily change the value comparatively because there is no change, right? Unless there was a lot of bidding up prior. But it fell at first as people unwound positions, then reality set in that as there was this concern about all these matters that the Fed was talking about, that a safety trade now was at hand. And where do you go? Well, you go into the yen for whatever reason. It's just the way it goes. The yen is a play on safety. And you go into the U.S. dollar. Unquestionably, you go into the U.S. dollar. Gold was up big. If you had noticed a few days up until, as a matter of fact, I talked about this on DH Unplugged, that if the Fed does not raise interest rates, gold could rally. And the gold miners themselves have rallied since Wednesday morning. If you take a look at that, pretty intense rally in gold, some metals. So going into this, you know, there must have been some reality check of many that said that, you know, the Fed is just not going to raise, and gold and the dollar had moved ahead of time into it. All right, what else do we got to talk about? Let's take a look here. Some good stories here. All right, let's go over some economics. Some things that happened last week. We'll kind of get rid of some of these things that I think are important to look at and end up this whole little section on economics and things of that nature. Let's see. We had retail sales out last week on Tuesday. Now, the actual came in at about 0.2%. The forecast was about anywhere from about 0.4, I would say. So that came in a little bit light. Prior was a 0.7. So we see a drop in retail sales. Even ex-auto, it came in pretty light. Industrial production, interestingly enough, was still negative, which I find really ironic on a month-over-month basis. Capacity utilization was still holding pretty solid at 77.6. Inventories were light again. Now, that's going to hit GDP. It's an interesting calculation when you look at the use of inventories in GDP, but inventories themselves will actually, when you have a rise in inventories, and when inventories increase and expand, actually GDP, that component of GDP will help out. On one hand, you could look at it as, wait a minute, if inventories rise, I could say that, well, people aren't buying things. Manufacturers are still pumping it out, and they're stockpiling it, but people aren't buying things. Isn't that the case? Well, yes, in a way. Or there could be a lot more orders coming in because the anticipation for a much better selling season or, you know, sales cycle is really at hand. And the fact is that it is goods that are produced. So therefore, you could say it's a positive. The problem is when inventories get a little bit out of whack with sales, the sales to inventory ratio or inventory to sales ratio, whenever you want to look at it as, when that gets a little out of whack and it is starting to rise right now, that ratio where you're seeing less sales and greater inventories, that's where the problem is, because manufacturing will probably start to slow down moving forward, you know, in the next few months. And the reason for that is very simple, right? Because what's going to happen is that business is going to look at their inventories and say, wait a minute, we don't see the sales really picking up here. We have all this inventory sitting around. We don't want to be stuck with any stale items that are, you know, involved in various seasonal purchases. We don't want to be sitting on any kind of products that are going to make us, you know, go on a major markdown. So when you look at that, you have to realize that that's where the real problem comes in, is the relationship of the inventories and sales, not just inventories alone and not just sales alone. So what we're seeing now, though, is this rise in the ratio, and a rise is negative, meaning, again, greater amount of inventory rise, lower sales. And the inventory rise could be a product of lower sales. So that's something that we've been looking at, and that's something that's pretty concerning here. Now, CPI in the inflation area was released on Wednesday, and we saw a negative 0.1% from a prior number of 0.1% to the positive side. Year over year, it was still about 1.6. The core CPI was about 0.1. That's the one that's year over year. And it's about 1.6 on a year over year basis. Housing market index hit a 62, one of the highest we've seen in terms of confidence of builders. in the last, I don't know, number of years. Crude inventory is just all over the place. You know, you see a lot of rig shutdowns and oil's moving higher, and then you see that inventories have a draw, but gasoline and distillates have a build, and it's just a very confusing environment right now because you're seeing a lot of production from the refiners who are trying to keep pace of making money and revenues in a very difficult situation they have here. But gas prices for a while were pretty high. I mean, you know, I don't know if you noticed, but the last few weeks they've been coming down very quickly. They were hanging in there, and then wham, they got whacked. And that's with oil rising, by the way. So there's kind of a change in the relationship that refiners were. They were refining cheap oil, selling it at higher gas. Now, all of a sudden, that's changed a little bit in the last couple of weeks. It's really interesting to see that long-term tick flows, where we see that money in to treasuries, U.S. sovereign debt, last month was about $100 billion of inflows. There's only $7 billion of inflows this month net because China sold, I think, about $50 billion worth as they were supporting their currency, if you remember that, and trying to stabilize their markets. They needed money. So they sold their bonds. And the concern is that there may be about $100 billion of bonds being sold next month because they're still having a very hard time supporting the currency, trying to stabilize that and their markets. And as such, they're bleeding. So when you look at that, you have to really put that together with all of the numbers that are coming out of China in terms of their economy, the negative sentiment on markets and the way that they're handling their entire process of trying to stimulate the economy, the devaluation that they surprised us all with, and now their current battle to stabilize everything because of their destabilizing impact that they had by all the very strange maneuvering and manipulation that they've had with markets. The Shanghai Index hit a low point last week. After all this being said, all this being done, the Shanghai Index still has had a very difficult time. Government is trying to put money in, but the confidence is lost. And once you lose the confidence of the retail, and you also shut down futures, and you shut down traders, and you shut down outside parties from trading, and not to mention go after short sellers and persecute and prosecute, etc., you know, the support is lost. Confidence is lost. And once you lose that, you got a big problem in markets. In terms of a few other things real quickly, leading indicators came in at 0.1. which was right on. That was fine. It was a little bit light, but there was a revision up a little bit. So you got to put that into the calculation. Philly Fed was a -6. That's one that I look at quite frequently. That dropped off. Again, manufacturing has been dropping off. And that's because of the inventory discussion we talked about earlier. Initial claims pretty low, 264,000. So the employment situation is still doing pretty well. A little bit lighter next week in terms of economics. We got existing home sales on Monday, looking for about 5.45 million, a little bit of a drop from prior. And then not much on Tuesday. Wednesday, you got a few things. Again, not much. Thursday's where it starts again. You got durable goods orders. Now, this should be very interesting with the climbing dollar of late. We've seen that durable goods has been pretty volatile. Looking for about a drop of about 3% or so from a plus 2.2%. Now, if you take out transportation, which is the volatile component of that, particularly airplanes, what you have is a drop of about 0.3%, where it was about 0.4% to the positive prior. And wrapping up the week, we'll have GDP coming out, looking for 3.5%, a little bit lighter than the 3.7 second revision, but that's still pretty good. I'll take that. And the Michigan sentiment, which has been dropping lately, coming in, looks like estimates are at about 86.5. So we'll take a look at that. That should be, I think that the economics are going to start being more important now that the Fed has done what they've done. So you really have to consider the fact that they are really putting the onus on current strength and extraordinary strength of the U.S. economy right now as they brought in the global environment. So it's going to be quite a bit of watching going on each and every point. So we'll probably see a lot more volatility is the point that I'm making here. All right, a couple other things that we want to talk about here. I thought this was a really interesting story. At the end of, I guess, into Friday, France's credit rating was cut by Moody's Investor Services, and it was taken down to AA2, which is still the third highest investment level. That's okay. But it was because of their political constraints and slow economic expansion. So we're seeing that major countries in Europe, even with the ECB fully backing those countries, we see a drop in their rating of their bonds. Now, this goes into a much bigger problem in that some of the funding that goes into what the ECB does in terms of bailouts and all sorts of accounts that are built in order to backstop have requirements in terms of ratings of the underlying countries of who can fund, et cetera. And some of this calls into question the potential for the funding mechanisms. However, now that the ECB has instituted and somehow got approved quantitative easing where they can essentially create money out of thin air, do we really care about the funding mechanisms by any of the countries, right? I mean, who cares if you could fund it from a country's fund when you just have an unlimited amount of money that you could think, you know, you can create? So keep a watch on that. It should be interesting what happens with some of the bond moves next week when it comes to Europe. Let's see here. This is kind of interesting. There was a story about, I was reading that, this kind of back and forth on the whole idea of what's going on with this generation and how, in fact, they are coping with all of the financial ruin that occurred not too many years ago. One of the things is that the housing market, it's kind of an interesting thing that about 15% of 25 to 34-year-olds are still living with their parents. This is for this is going on a fourth year of increase in the rate of those people in that age range living at home. It's the highest since the 1960s. And it's being blamed on a lasting scar from the recession that we saw, the deepest economic contraction since the 1930s. And there's a financial challenge which is creating a problem in inequity. So one of the problems is that we do know for a fact that clearly with this whole quantitative easing, wealth effect, and the whole process that went on to reflate the economy and financial assets, that really the rich got richer, or those at least that had those assets that were targeted have gotten a lot better. Because, you know, those moved up very nicely and they surpassed where they were prior to the big drop, et cetera. But the problem is that still the wage gap is there. And therefore what's happening is that the people that didn't have money, that were not in the workforce, are no better off. In fact, they're worse off because wage pressures did not increase as rapidly as, let's say, the inflation and cost increases of homes. So if you weren't in on that early, if you didn't get to buy a house with those very depressed levels as your, let's say, your first home, and you're looking to buy a house now, particularly in some of the areas that have come back to where they were prior, the problem is that your wages are not meeting the same level to allow you to do so. Now, this is not 100%. Of course, this is just a study of this particular segment of 25 to 34-year-olds, and this is a big problem. Now, there's some benefits here. There's some good things that talk about how, well, once they actually are working longer and they are able to put money aside and they are able to get stabilization in their jobs and a wage increase, there is going to be an enormous amount of people that will be looking to buy homes, that will actually be out there and, you know, really drying up any kind of liquidity that's out there in terms of homes, and will be doing so in a way that will help the home builders, help home prices, and do a lot to the growth of the home sector, the real estate sector in total. But we already know that rents have gone up dramatically. We know this in retail. We know this in retail stores and establishments. We also know this in terms of individuals and what they can afford to rent. Prices have gone up, even though there is just an amazing amount of multifamily homes, rentals that are being built The fact is that rental prices have gone up dramatically. It's very, very expensive compared to the wage base to actually live just from the perspective of owning or renting. So kind of an interesting story, I thought, and I don't know how you feel about that, but you know, this is the thing I think that gets us all about this concept of there's no inflation, but yet, bam, it costs a lot more to live. I think the underlying fact is that while there may not be inflation, the problem is that wage increases, wage pressures have not kept up with the basic inflation rate. That's where the problem, and maybe that's what we're seeing from individual views as the biggest problem. All right, let's see what else I got here. Ah, by the way, if you don't listen, I'm not sure. I got to talk to John about this, but this week is a Jewish holiday. On Tuesday evening is the Erev, or evening before Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And this week, of course, is a holy week for all those of the Jewish faith, where Rosh Hashanah begins it. It's the beginning of the new year, and it's a period of time where you reflect and you do your best to figure out what it is that maybe you've done wrong, what you could do right, kind of ask for forgiveness, start anew. And it ends with Yom Kippur, where the night before you usually get together with family, and then the next day you fast, don't eat from the evening of sunset to the sunset the next day. And then you're so hungry, you eat it. You know, you eat everything you can for about 5 minutes and you're stuffed. It's kind of a tough day because you go to, you know, usually go to temple during the day, or at least do your best. I always said that, you know, when I'm home during Yom Kippur and I'm not eating all day, somehow it seems, and maybe it's just me, but there's an inordinate amount of food commercials on television. Anyway, I got to talk to John about whether or not we're going to probably move it to Wednesday this week, or actually not do it. There was an interesting story related to Fitbit this week that I want to talk to you about. You know, we talked about how Fitbit, we were concerned about this being a fad, an area that was full of competition and may or may not be a place that we want to invest, or maybe even short. Now, the story goes that Target is offering all their employees, about 300,000 employees, a free entry-level Fitbit. It's about a $65 device. The entry-level one, you get it for free if you want it. And obviously you can wear it if you want, or not wear it if you want. They're hoping that you would wear it. And I don't know if you saw this story, but I stopped for a moment and started thinking about this and saying, well, why would they want to do this? So I started to kind of, you know, go through the whole scenario. And there was a couple of things that stood out to me. First, this would be good for Target if, in fact, employees en masse, you know, a lot of them really did not only wear them, but start somehow magically, just because they have the Fitbit on, to work on better health and fitness habits. I can't imagine that somehow just having this, you know, device that counts how many steps you walked, how many miles you went, your heart rate, potentially, I guess, I don't know if the entry level has that, your sleep habits, etc. I am not quite sure if that by itself is going to instill the desire for anybody to really start to have better eating habits, not go to McDonald's and glom on a Big Mac and a, you know, large fries and a chicken nuggets and throw in a McRib if it's available, or if they're going to say, hey, you know what, I got this and I'm going to do my best, by golly, to really turn over another leaf. Hard to imagine this. But if, in fact, let's just pretend for a moment that they did, that all of a sudden the employees got together because not only did Target put out this free offer, but somehow they were smart enough to have a really good plan of action internally from an HR perspective to market this and to integrate this really well into the daily functionality and to the edicts of the company. In other words, the company's mission is all these things, and one of them is for employee health and fitness, right? All this. It's the promotion of good fitness and eating habits, as well as longevity of life for our employees. They put that into play, and they have their HR department segregated an area that they're going to deal with this. Maybe they'll put out, I don't know, Target shorts on short commercials to their employees about, hey, here's a fitness idea for the today. Here's a menu that you may want to look at. Here's some alternative eating habits. Here's an exercise program that you may want to get involved in. Here's a discount to a gym. Again, if they go ahead and do that, which would be very smart, by the way, to do so, even with the help of Fitbit, then they get to probably have some savings on their health insurance, because the health insurance company or even part of their self-insurance component would probably have or potentially have less claims, assuming that nobody fell on the treadmill and hurt themselves, sprained their ankle while they were running, got hit by a car on a bicycle, God forbid, or died to a point that they were dehydrated and had to be hospitalized. Aside from that, it would seem that there would be a real benefit to the overall health potential for employees, therefore dropping the cost of insurance, which could amount to a very significant amount of money. Because I don't think that Target is just being altruistic and fun and saying, hey, I have a great idea. Let's just give away a Fitbit. There's more reason, and there's more of a corporate financial reason behind the whole thing for them to spend. Well, that's another question. We don't know if they're spending actually the retail price. I would doubt it highly, which brings me to my next point. If they are not buying it for retail price, if they're buying it for a much lower wholesale cost, probably a pretty substantial deal for them at buying 300,000 of these deals, then you have to wonder the net benefit to Fitbit. Now, there's been a few bullish arguments after this deal was announced last week and the stock rallied pretty well into it. But the question remains, how much does this really move the needle in terms of their sales and in terms of their profitability? Now, of course, if you look at this in a different way, if you say, well, hold on a second. I understand that maybe margins on this particular deal are tighter. And I understand that, they get the revenue in, but there may not be as much profitability. But if you think about this, this is a major step in the evolution of companies bringing health and fitness tracking devices that are wearables, and they're going to go to Fitbit as the play. I don't know. That's kind of thin. You don't know if that's going to happen or not, whether or not other companies will follow suit. Obviously, they'll wait some time to see if there is any benefit and collective benefit from any announcements from Target. If, in fact, that they saw a health insurance companies come in and say, hey, by the way, if you do this, we will, in fact, lower your costs. So right now, that's a little bit questionable. But even if it was the case, you have to look at what the margins would be and if that really would help or, in fact, hurt Fitbit. Because, and the other companies in the sector, if they're buying the lowest cost item, which probably has margins that are, X, and now they're buying it for a lot less, and the margins go down. And if this happens over and over again, it becomes a major component of their sales, then what? Right? I mean, would this be a stepping stone for some people to say, hey, this is the basic model. Oh, I want the other model, and I'll buy it myself if I have to. I'm not so sure about that. There's some definite holes in the bullish argument for this. I still think that there's a lot of competition here. I mean, just look at what happened with GoPro as an example. Now, a little bit of a different scenario here. I think it's front page it's somewhere in Barron's these days that there is a tremendous amount of competition. You saw what happened after the iPhone announcement and their, specialized cameras, et cetera. Clearly not a GoPro, but as more devices have cameras in them, as more companies come out with competition, GoPro is just sinking. It's just ugly. Barron's came out with, I think, something that they can go 50% lower at this point or something of that nature in this weekend's discussion, which between me and you is sometimes a good time to think about closing your shorts. But nonetheless, I would look at about 42.5 on Fitbit, approximately 42.5 technically, as an area that you may want to short into, at least fade if it does start to rise up. It was pretty good in a downward market last week. Now, I'll give you some quick example. We did short it at about 38, bought it back at about 31 or 32. Shorted again at about 38. Went down about 32 again. And then after this announcement rose up, we closed the position at the entry points. There was no loss, no gain there, and held off on actually shorting again until we see that 42.5 or so level, and we'll start to slowly get into that. There has been definitely some bullish momentum on the stock. It's definitely been a good move after the announcement and during a time of very significant uncertainty with markets. But if you look at prior to that, the momentum had been really coming in pretty strongly. So the other question is, you know, how many people will continue to wear it? You know, are you, if this all is a deal for the health insurance and for the health insurance cost benefit, then you have to ask yourself, well, how many people will actually not only wear it, but continue to wear it for some time if it is a requirement for the insurance cost to go down, right? You think about that. So if, in fact, we are seeing that people wear it for a time, a couple of months, and then they're like tired of it, what's going to hold the employee of Target to continue wearing it for some time after, let's say, they get tired of it? The company going to say, well, we really need you to do this for us because of the cost of healthcare will come down. Except I don't think employees really care about that as long as they're not paying for it. So take a look at that. And I think that's interesting. All right, let's look at FireEye, F-E-Y-E. And one of the things that you've definitely noticed is the constant flow of stories related to hacking, data intrusion. Problem about data security. Time and time again, you see, well, the federal government, the IRS, post office. And I guess something from a company the other day that said that data has been breached. I don't have anything on there, but data has been breached. Your credit card information could have been stolen, et cetera, et cetera. Keep on the lookout. I don't think that I have, I can't think of an institution, and there's probably a lot of them, but any that hasn't had something that they're concerned about or something that's happened. Major banks have gotten hacked, data breached. We know about the Ashley Madison situation. Obviously, that's a weird one. But it seems to me to be a no-brainer to be looking at the companies that are involved intimately with cybersecurity. And in light of the few companies that are out there that really specialize in this area and the potential and reality of this being an ongoing threat, an ongoing problem for companies into the future, as long as we are fully embracing the internet, the cloud, online storage, and even, you know, anything that we don't embrace, what companies will utilize for transaction processing across, you know, across the world. I mean, how else do you do it? Besides the old days, remember the old days? You would go into your credit card, you'd buy something and you use your credit card. They take that crazy machine that would take your credit card, put it in there, and a couple pieces of paper that were attached to a little ticket. They would move it over, which would essentially be a roller that would imprint on the carbon copy, on the carbon area of the credit card receipt, right? They would make a call to some call center that would give them a code. You'd read the card to them, you'd give them a code. Code 72, code 42. Okay, approved. And then the store was then off the hook if it was a problem because the card was approved by the credit card company, or at least a little bit better security. Everything was offline. Everything was stored at the central location of the credit card companies, et cetera. And, you know, you'd have to breach that would be much more difficult. Now there's two-way channels where they just slide your card, you get authorization quickly, it's done because it's all handled in a two-way open mechanism that has security on top of it. So the problem is that you have all of this going on, whether or not you put it out there or it's out there because of the fact that you are transacting or doing something. And now it seems to me that for some of these companies, whether it's an Oracle that is having difficulty in continuing with their revenue growth and their overall growth of earnings, whether it's a Microsoft, even though they just increased their dividend last week and they are rolling out this new operating system, but major companies like these are looking for opportunities to roll in companies that can provide them ongoing revenue streams. And it would seem likely to me, or at least a smart idea, that they would look for these cybersecurity companies to roll in. It would be a natural roll in. They already have all of the technology involved. They have the relationships. You know, you look at what IBM has. You look at what all these major companies have in terms of their client base and the data protection issues and how they are so closely integrated with the development and the protection mechanisms. I would think that they'd want to have specialty areas that would help them to not only help protect the things that they're dealing with so they wouldn't have to buy from a third party potentially, or in order to provide them that additional rolled up revenue stream, right? Because they already have revenue. So it becomes, I think, a very smart idea for investors to look at the various names that are out there. And there's not a big list of them, but you can look at the components of a company called HACK, which is the ETF, H-A-C-K, and there's a bunch of them in there. You got Palo Alto Networks probably at the top of the list with FireEye. You'll have Oracles, you'll have Microsoft. They have some of that in there, Symantec, et cetera. You know, these kind of names that are circled around very often as the ones that are involved in the whole security of databases, security of the internet, and encryption issues. But FireEye, which I found interesting, it could have been just the Friday effect of options expiration, but in a very poor tape, there was a little hint of some M&A activity that was in the background, and it got a nice bid. FireEye the stock has not been great. Even though they've had decent reports, they're just not executing, I think, tremendously well from a management standpoint. But again, that's another reason why the board and investors could, in fact, be very, very positive on them being a takeout candidate and very positive on and very welcoming of another company coming in and purchasing it. So take a look at that. That was FireEye. China. So there's been some questions that came in that I received via Twitter and email. You could email me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can talk to me on Twitter. The handle is Andrew Horowitz, one word. And by the way, I want to mention something. I was looking at the new podcast app on the iPhone. A little bit different. It used to have subcategories inside of business for investing news, savings, whatever it was. Now they just have one category, which is just business. But I took a look at the podcast, this podcast, and I noticed there was like 400 or 500 reviews, and we got like a 5-star rating. If you have the opportunity and inclination and desire, do me a favor, go over to iTunes and put a quick review in there. I think it's very helpful, and I like reading them. They have them in a weird order, by the way. They have the oldest one first, which doesn't make any sense to me. It should be the newest one first, right? I don't know that while they have a review from 2007 as the first review. And then you have to scroll. I mean, add more, scroll to get to the latest review. It makes no sense. They should have it would seem to me at least, they should have the latest on the top of the list. That would seem pretty obvious. But this has been actually, they've done that for years. Anyway, leave your review on iTunes and let me know, let others know that you love the show. Of course, if you have a negative review, please do me a favor, do not put it on there. All right, let's take a look at China. A couple of questions came in on the whole China issue. Where are we? What's going on? Well, the government has been pumping in billions of dollars into their markets directly. We saw that there was, I think, a 5% move on one day last week. It happened in like an hour and a half at the close of the markets. Oftentimes, the government will come in and actually, they'll do their buying at the end of the day. They want to make sure they lock in the deal, right? So if they did the buying in the beginning of the day, what happens? Well, people could sell into it. If you do your buying at the end of the day, they close the market at the end of the day, nobody could sell into it. You have to wait till the next day. Right, so if you combat all the sales at the end of the day and really press markets higher, good thing. So it was up like, I don't know, 4 or 5%. Then it came back down, and the Shanghai is now testing 3,000 or so. Really tough situation for them. Very, very difficult market conditions right now. As I mentioned, that there's a weak market because the government has done so with all of their churning and moving and manipulating, and really the seems to me that the retail buyers are saying, sayonara, we're done. You know, we're out of here. And the only incremental buyer really at this point appears to be the Chinese government. So there's a really big inequity in the amount of money that they put in that they've lost, by the way, because the markets are lower now than they were as they were putting money in to prop up markets along the way. So while there was a very temporary relief in the valuation decline as they were buying here and there, the overall net reaction and valuation, when you look at it in total, has been a negative deal. They'd have to put $100 billion into their markets, to, even though their markets are small, to get. I mean, they're down $4 trillion in market cap if you combine all of the Chinese equity markets since the high in April. We still think there's a ways to go. Right now, the index is at approximately a zero point in the Shanghai from where it was at the beginning of the year. So the 60% move on the upside has been combated by a major selling force, and it took that down 40-something percent back down to zero. What says that it can't go negative at this point? Especially because the government has not been able to stabilize it. We are short the Hang Seng Index, which is the Hong Kong Index. A lot of problems in that area as well. We're seeing that much of the monies that used to flow into that area from China, one of the biggest places that would bring money into Hong Kong, and a lot of it was in very high-end items, very high-end liquor, retail, apparel, women's purses, etc., very high-end cars. A lot of that is really showing signs of extreme slowdowns right now, where many companies that used to occupy the Fifth Avenues, quote-unquote, of Hong Kong are pulling their stores out because the cost of being there and the amount of money that they're making does not make any sense. And we are seeing that there is a major slowdown in Macau, and a lot of that is due to the government's crackdown on grafting practices, or the ability for individuals in the government to create sweet side deals that are giving them all sorts of money into their pockets rather than a better deal for the citizens in taxes. So they're kind of doing the bad thing by quoting out and dealing with people that will give them kickbacks. I guess that's what grafting kickbacks, same kind of thing. Skimming, same kind of thing. And what's happened is because there is such a limitation on this, and they are also involved with a tattletale system where if you see that a major official is, for example, buying expensive cars or maybe ordering a bottle of whiskey that's, you know, $5,000 or champagne, there is a tattletale system where you tell on them and therefore there will be rewards and something done about it. Before, there was nothing. They would ignore it. Now they got everybody looking after everybody, and therefore, why would you do things that would get yourself in trouble if you were an official? Keep it quiet. Keep it on the lowdown. But that's why Macau is suffering so dramatically, and now Hong Kong is feeling the pain as well. So that, I think that's something you need to watch for, is the continuation of a slowdown in that area and the stocks in that area. This week, we saw that Baidu, major player in, they have the majority. They have a tremendous market when it comes to the quote-unquote Google of China. They're the search engine. They bought a lot of other companies, do a lot of other things, but they're the search engine of the number one search engine in China. They're talking about coming off of the NASDAQ and trading over in China exclusively. Now they IPO'd on the NASDAQ and things were going pretty well. They had decent earnings run and all of a sudden things are starting to kind of spiral. One of the things they want to do is try to get the benefit of the IPO opportunity that was there 6 months ago in the China markets. And on top of that, if you really think about it, whenever you see that a company like a Baidu in particular is looking to come off of the NASDAQ, we'll see what happens with Alibaba. They're looking to hide something. They're looking for a much softer environment of regulation where they do not have to provide all the details of what they're doing and how they're doing. It's kind of like, in a way, one step going closer to being private as a company, because there's less disclosures needed and their particular securities regulator is much softer. So when you see that kind of thing, it is a warning flag for a company. It may be good that they go private for a much higher amount. So the company may come in, let's say, I'm just going to give you an example. Chinese company A is trading at $50 a share. They were at $100 a share some time ago. They're thinking about, and they're going to go private. What will happen is that the stock may be bought by the current shareholders for, let's say, $75. Because they know that if they come off of the exchange here, they're just buying the shares back of themselves anyway. And then they'll put them on the Chinese market, and hopefully the IPO market will really pop them. But the problem now is that with the lack of confidence in China, that may not play as well as it has. Let's end this discussion with the Republican debate just very quickly from a comedic and entertainment standpoint, not taking a particular political side here, but I thought it was really interesting and funny. I do it for the comic relief. I find it fascinating that there was so much focus put on Donald Trump. It was like, okay, let me ask Jeb Bush. Jeb, Donald Trump said blah, 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 blah. What do you say? And this would go on throughout the evening. It was almost like it wasn't a takedown of Donald Trump. It was a focus on Donald Trump and all the things that he said, whether they were good or bad, and how the other interplay with it. And I thought it was interesting because then you'd get Donald Trump talking about something and then somebody else would then chime in, and it kept on getting back to Donald Trump. Everything got back to Donald Trump. And I thought it was interesting that CNN did such a thing. You know, they allowed that kind of concentration. Yes, I get that they were kind of putting the main players in the middle and the outliers on the end, focusing the questions for those leading in the polls and less for those that were not. But it seems to me that a debate should be even-handed. Everybody has equal position, equal say, equal time, or at least equal time contemplated. They could potentially take more time if they have more things thrown at them by other debaters. But I don't know what you thought. I thought it was kind of funny. Sad in a way too, but funny. I don't know where we're going to go with this. It seems to me that Donald Trump's political aspirations are very high. His foreign policy potential is very, it's questionable. And it's obvious that there's a few on that particular panel, the debate panel that we saw, that have the opportunity to be president and the potential qualifications to be president. But if they're going to continue to be wrapped up in what Donald said and what he didn't say and fighting for their lives to try to stay above water, beyond the entertainment value of the tit-for-tat commentary, defending themselves, their looks, their record, not their record so much, but their just the surface area issues with Donald Trump, I think it's a real loser for all of us. Hopefully they'll get into the meat and potatoes of all this. We'll see what happens with that. And on the Democratic side, we'll see if actually there is any kind of movement on the Biden camp. And if, in fact, there's going to be some kind of announcement in that area that will help us have a differential and opportunity for a choice in the Democratic side as well. We'll see. Anyway, you can write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We have some great guests coming up next week. I want to spend a little more time on some of the topics this week that were important, but next week and the following weeks, we have a few great guests coming up. Make sure to listen to DH Unplugged and head over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com to check out Aero Strategy and the TDI Managed Growth Strategy. You'll be glad you did. Thanks for joining me, and I'll see you again next week.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor, regulated in various states. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.